Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You are listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning.
Morning.
And welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms. And we do get to play some rather cool music as well. You've got Julian Pauly live in the studio as usual. Later in this hour, we'll be talking to our PG. We think he might be talking about Africa. Ooh. Ooh. And we've also got our guest speaker for this week, and indeed every first Saturday of the month, it's Phil Muffett from the Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society. He'll be doing his Eye on the Sky Club news, etc. He's currently at Manvers Waterfront Boat Club. You can check their website out, mwbc.org.uk. They do all sorts of amazing things. All being well next week, and indeed every second Saturday of the month, Dr. Ogo Osmore will be back from his summer recess, we hope. Let's see. But next up in the science news this week.
Yes, heart disease could soon be diagnosed in the blink of an eye. Thanks to superhuman software, leading cardiologists have said it was one of several breakthroughs in heart disease technology to be announced at the European Society of Cardiology, or ESC, Congress in Munich. The software uses artificial intelligence alongside an ECG to uncover signs of heart disease hidden from the human eye. It could fast-track higher-risk patients into treatment. Next, the first plug-in solar panels for UK homes went on sale last week, inspired by the success of similar products in Germany, where about 1.3 million plug-in solar kits have been registered since rules were relaxed in 2024. I wonder where you can buy them from.
Oh, supermarkets. Really? Aldi, yeah.
Oh, Aldi, wow.
Yeah.
Middle aisle.
Maybe.
A nature reserve on the site of former dumping ground in Cheshire is now the most significant nesting site for the black-necked grebe, one of the UK's rarest breeding birds. The Wolston Eyes Reserve, situated alongside the Manchester Ship Canal, is home to 35 pairs of the species, 64% of Britain's breeding population.
All good stuff. Next up is a bit of a story about eggs. It was in the Sunday Times magazine, I think it was a while back actually. And so it was quite a big article, but I've just chosen a couple of pieces out of it. So what is an egg? It is a self-contained life support system, says the ornithologist Tim Burkhead in his book, The Most Perfect Thing. Formed from the inside out, okay, yolk first, then white, then the protective shell. That all happens in the female bird's fallopian tube-like oviduct. And the egg contains everything that a growing chick needs. There are nutrients and energy in the yolk and the albumen or egg white. Provides water, protein and cushioning. And what embryonic chicks need to grow, humans happen to find very tasty. If the egg isn't fertilized and no chick develops, that leaves all the more deliciousness for us. So why do we eat hen's eggs? Well, chickens became the go-to laying bird because they were the easiest and most economical to farm. There are now about 43 million commercial laying hens in the UK, 300 times the number of ducks, which produce our second most popular egg. But we can eat the eggs of just about any bird. During the Second World War, the Russian oologist, can you believe? That's a word, which means egg expert, oologist, one for Scrabble, I reckon. Lev Belopsky helped the authorities feed the cut-off Arctic pork of Murmansk on seabird eggs thanks to his knowledge of local guillemot colonies. Some people claim seabirds' fishy diet flavours their eggs, but all eggs taste broadly the same. Few really interesting facts there about eggs. And then another article was in a kitchen clinic from an article in the Sunday Times as well. And I know it might not feel like the weather for barbecuing now, but this is a column where experts answer readers' questions. So somebody had written in and asked, what is the mallard reaction and how can I use it to be a better barbecue cook? I have to say it's not a term I'd come across before. So when it comes, the answer was, when it comes to anything to do with barbecuing meat, the person writing the article deferred to the British grill expert Genevieve Taylor, who does a great job of explaining this process in her book called Seared. And this is a summary of that book's description of the mallard reaction. So the mallard reaction is the sequence of events that happen when you sear, colour and brown meat. It's more than just caramelisation. It's a chemical reaction that occurs between simple sugars and amino acids when food is heated, leading to a chain reaction that produces hundreds of new flavour molecules. So in short, it's the reason barbecue food tastes so delicious. And with meat, you don't need high temperatures for this to take place. A minimum of 120 degrees Celsius is fine, but you need time. The lower the temperature, the longer the reaction takes. The optimal temperature for a quick mallard technique is 150 to 160 degrees Celsius. And removing moisture from the meat also promotes browning. As for the name, the mallard reaction, it came from a French chemist who first described the process in 1912. Great article there by Anna Evans in the Kitchen Clinic in the Sunday Times. What is a mallard reaction and how does it help me barbecue food better?
It was all small stuff at first. Like microwave radiation causes autism on your grandchildren. Then it built up to every time you use shampoo, it gets inside your head and tells you what to do. Conspiracy got me a little worried about being free, about being me. Conspiracy got me a little worried about being free, about being me. Maybe I should excuse myself from society and think of other people as pieces of me to do with what I please. 'Cause that would benefit me. As long as no one else is looking. We'll society. And think of other people as pieces of meat. To do with what I please.
Brilliant, eh? A track called Red Meat there from a band called Legless Trials from 2023. I think that was one of RPG's choices for Glorious Rock Show, actually. Nice bit of punk there, because we were talking about the Mallard reaction, which happens when you barbecue. Interesting, eh? Of course, you listen to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have RPG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Oh, loud and clear. Oh, that's what we like. You never know on live radio, Paul, do you?
You never know.
Yeah, surprising everything.
It is. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week, then?
Well, a couple of things that come together about breathing again. I sort of caught another article which talked about square breathing or box breathing, as they call it. And it's a way for people to deal with rising panic and things like that. So basically you exhale for four, a count of four. You hold for a count of four. You then inhale for a count of four and start again and exhale for a count of four. And by doing that, it tends to calm your system down and reduce sort of panic attacks. So I thought it was kind of an interesting starter on exhaling. But then I found an article which says that if you exhale for longer, it may push your brain towards making bolder decisions.
Oh,
So it's kind of, okay. It's one of those things. I think sometimes when you face some kind of a challenge, you do take a deep breath in and go, and it's like builders do when they give you a price. But this is from the German Center for Diabetes Research, and they said that slow breathing with a prolonged exhale made people more willing to take risks by changing the heart activity and increasing the brain's sensitivity to rewards. So the findings suggest that something as simple as controlling your breath can directly influence how you evaluate your choices. And the new study suggested that by deliberately changing the rhythm of your breathing, you can influence how you make decisions, because you alter the activity of your heart and brain. So researchers from the German Institute of Human Nutrition at Potsdam, they found that the longer exhalations increased heart rate variability and made the brain more responsive to rewards, which was associated with the bolder choices. So it says that fast breathing and an elevated heart rate are often linked with rapid decision-making. So, again, it's that thing about facing some kind of a challenge. You take a deep breath in and get yourself organized to deal with whatever it is that's facing you. And it says that under pressure, people may become more cautious in an effort to avoid losses. And it tends to shorten your breathing, slower, shorter breathing, which puts you into a bit more of a panic mode. So by using slower breathing and calmer cardiovascular state, they can encourage you to make more positive assessment of a potential outcome and make people more willing to take risks. So I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But decision-making has traditionally been viewed as a process centered mainly in your brain. And this new research examines how the broader possibilities that signals from other parts of your body can change that brain activity and influence the choices you make. So the study was led by Professor Soo-Young Q. Park in collaboration with researchers from institutions around the globe. And they said that our decisions are rarely determined solely by the external information. Rather, our judgment emerges from the interplay between cognitive processes and our current bodily state. And it's previously unknown how the consciousness the conscious regulation of our body, for example, through targeted breathing, could actively control our decision-making process. We wanted to create a physiological shift using a slow breathing pattern to change the quality of our decisions. And I said, well, okay, testing whether longer exhales change those decisions. They studied four healthy participants while they made risky choices under carefully controlled breathing conditions. And the participants followed visual breathing instructions and either breathed at their normal individual pace or slowed their breathing while ascending to their exhalation phase in a ratio of 2-8. And as the participants completed the series of risk-related decisions, the research team measured several aspects of their physical and neurological responses. Functional magnetic resonance. Oh, there goes my new clock.
Oh, funny that, because Paul wants a clock like that, but do you not find it annoying, Paul?
I do slightly, but my my other half loves it to bits. So that was 11 o'clock. So it's running slightly behind.
Oh, it's
right. Cheap one then. It's cheap.
Time to walk as well. Does it wake you up at night, Paul, as well?
No, I'm pretty good at sleeping. But it chimes the hour and one for the half hour. So I'll stop talking before the one comes.
Paul, where did you get that from? Where did you get that clock? Yeah.
It's a chap who sort of refurbishes clocks. Ooh. And Jan was looking for something because she likes the tick and also likes the chime, just sort of historically. So she found this, and it's a refurbished clock. Wow. That we just had for a day, so it's kind of settling in because they are a bit picky about, you know, the conditions and things.
But, interesting. I bet the cat don't like it.
Well, he's kind of amused a bit.
Yeah.
Because you hear it actually starting to wind up, ready to chime. So he's looking at it.
Brilliant.
Good stuff.
Amazing.
Oh, God. When you chose the clock, did Jan breathe out slowly?
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? So, with this exhalation, they checked the pattern of breathing, and the combination of measurements allowed the researchers to test whether that extended exhalation had improved things. So the results showed the extended exhalation slowed the heart rate and was associated with riskier choices. And importantly, the change appeared to come from greater attention to possible rewards rather than the reduced concern about potential losses. So it kind of just leans in towards so many things, doesn't
well, it? Well, it makes me think of when you go shopping and you can't decide what top to buy or whatever. Then, if you know, you can be applying this technique, couldn't you?
Yes, yeah, I think it's it is one of those things. And I say box breathing sort of does just calm you down. So it's a good thing to remember. And I know, sort of teaching a lot of people with radio work, if you sit down slumped forward, you actually compress your diaphragm. So you start to breathe more sort of shallowly and quickly, which means that you can sort of run out of breath when you're speaking on radio. So it's a good thing to stretch things out and inhale. And I think for people who do voiceover work, quite often they can stand up.
Yes.
To a microphone rather than
it's like singing, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you're sat down, it's not quite the same, is it? You can't quite give it that welly.
Yeah, that's the thing. So it's interesting. Anyway, they say what the findings could mean for breathing techniques, and the work adds to a growing field focused on body-brain communication, supports neurovisceral models, which propose that a person's physical state can strongly shape the cognitive processes. So I guess what they're saying is that a lot of those things that you kind of get to sort of understand over time, you can realise when you catch yourself sort of breathing shallowly and quickly and be panicking, and that's when you can apply the sort of box or the square breathing technique, and sort of calms your thought processes down a bit, and perhaps helps make you better decisions. So I thought it was quite an interesting sort of link up through that sort of breathing technique and developments. I think also there was a bit of research about a seafood diet, eating sea squirts, they found could possibly help with regenerating some brain activity. And I think the problem is going to be finding sea squirts if you want to go down that route. so that was that. But anyway, one of the things that's a kind of a familiar sight these days is what they call the Mercator map representation of the world. And we've spoken about this before, how maps can influence things, and how a lot of wars are being fought over the interpretation of what's where on a map and who belongs where and what belongs to who. So maps have been important. The Mercator map found a way to put the world across on a single sheet, rather than it's really a re-representation of the way the globes are formed with little sort of arced sections through it. And it's become the standard representation around the world. And then once it had been established, because this was by a chap called Mercator, who sort of 450 years ago, I think it was, created that view as a way to put down on paper the whole world, which is better than previous attempts at showing the maps had been. I think I spoke the other week about Mary Beard did a piece where she was talking about some of the first representations of a map, in effect, and it ended up being a 22-foot-long scroll to show the Roman route from Rome to Spain. And it was a kind of linear map, a bit like the underground maps, or in fact Sheffield's tram maps, where they show you the stops on along the line. But this Mercator gave the whole world representation. But they started to find that actually it had distorted the placement and size of some countries. And so scroll forward to modern day, and the UN had a vote on a change to the representation of the world in maps to have a truer representation of the size of countries. And the vote was based around the representation of Africa. And if you look on the Mercator representation, Africa's shown kind of roughly about the size of Greenland, but in reality, it's about 14 times bigger. So that's the kind of distortion that you can find. And they're saying that basically it's about its own representation of Africa is about 40% smaller than it should be. The proposal is to consolidate a new map that shows that real size for Africa. And that went to a UN vote. I think something like 169 countries voted for the change. And I think America didn't vote on that. It's one of those things. I mean, again, when you talk about breathing and control, if you look at maps, they too can have an impact on the way people make assessments. So just showing a continent the size of Africa, I think we spoke about it before in the way that people outside of Africa view it, it sort of diminishes its role in the world a bit. It's kind of important to get representations right, to get them to be more accurate. We depend a lot on maps. I think the danger could be if you were thinking about solo voyages and you looked at the Mercator map, you might think that you were going to get around Africa a lot quicker than you can. So the real world consequences for maps, and I think, you know, it's just maybe can reconstitute a bit the actual importance and size of Africa as a continent.
Yeah, but it's a big change, isn't it, to existing maps and sailing charts as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I say it's really difficult. I think in this world of GPS now, we can sort of happily look at that, but if the GPS fails, which is one of the scenarios that you can see, and we're already seeing it being distorted for various sort of activities, we've got these constellations of satellites. So if something catastrophic happened and we lost GPS, we would have to go back to old map systems. And the problem was with many of the ancient maps, they were incomplete. They weren't really scaled properly. So if you were setting out from Europe to discover a new continent like America, it was a bit of a roulette game. you set off in the general direction until you hit something.
You fell off the end.
Yeah, so and hence all the stories of sailing off the end of the world, because it was beyond the range of our maps.
Oh,
and
yeah, brilliant.
Actually discovering that the world's round and not just a flat plate is quite interesting. But I think it's quite interesting that in modern times it's got a lot of support from other nations to actually reconstitute Africa on maps at something more like its real size. So that was the kind of stuff that caught my eye this week.
And you've picked a great track, Paul, to go with it.
Yeah, well, I thought a bit of Toto and Africa might go down well.
Brilliant stuff, Paul. And we shall speak to you Monday, Glory Days Rock Show 1 till 3 as well.
Looking forward to it.
All right, Paul, bye-bye. Bye.
Cheers. Bye. Bye.
She's coming in 12:30 flight. The moonlit wings reflect the stars that guide me towards salvation. I stopped an old man along the way, hoping to find some old forgotten words or ancient melodies. He turned to me as if to say, "Hurry, boy, it's waiting there for you.
dogs cry out in the night as they grow restless, longing for some solitary company. I know that I must do what's right, sure as Kilimanjaro rises like Olympus above the Serengeti. I seek to cure what's deep inside, frightened of this thing that I've become.
Track there, Africa by Toto, of course, and we played that because RPG was talking about Africa being upset about Mercator projection, so we might be seeing a change to our maps and representation of the real size of a country. It's all good stuff. Of course, listen to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM, talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning from 11 till 12. We should have Phil Muffett on the line. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us again.
Welcome.
I know you're at Manvers Waterfront Boat Club, though, today, not in your conservatory.
I'm back home now in my office.
Are you? Oh, are you?
Yeah, I'm back home in my office. Yes, I was there this morning doing a run.
I see. Now then, interestingly, tell me about why there's no swimming in Manvers Lake.
Okay, so there's traces of blue-green algae in the lake. So we've not had a bloom. So it's not been toxic, it's not been dangerous as what it can be, but there are traces in it, so for health and safety reasons, and we don't want anybody getting anything, the club's kind of shut the lake for a month.
Now, is this to do with the warmth of the water then?
Well, lack of rain, so the water's not been flushing through the lake, and also it's been excessively hot this year. We've not done the chart this year, not yet, but it has definitely been above average so far this year for water temperature. I'm reckoning it's going to be definitely a lot up on the last few years.
So,
the past 2 years, the actual temperature's been dropping by about a quarter of a degree for the past 2 years, but the previous like 6, 7, 8 years, it's all been rising. It leveled off and decreased last 2 years. It's definitely picked up this year.
Wow.
So it'll be interesting. When I get the stats in by the end of the year, it'll be interesting to see what's been going on.
So when did it last bloom then on that lake, out of interest?
Well, I've been going there before COVID, and we've not had a blue-green algae problem.
So what happens if it does bloom then? What makes that toxic, do you know?
It's the microbes in the algae. If it gets into your digestive system, it attacks your, I think it's either your liver or your kidneys, and it can lead to liver and kidney failure.
Really?
This happens to dogs as well. I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but
wow.
if your dog goes in the water and they consume it, you see if it gets into your system, and it can attach your body function.
So that's a big problem then for manvers, because it's a lot of it's water based, isn't it?
It is, yeah, quite a lot of it is, yeah. So, it's not bloomed though. It's not gone rampant. There's just traces of it. The thing is, if you've got birds flying in and out, which they are, they're moving around. So birds have had the chicks. They've all learnt to fly, and some of them have moved on. Some of them have come in. Some of them have gone. So if they get any on the feet or the feathers, they can migrate and transfer this stuff around different water bodies.
Interesting.
So it's likely to have come in via a
bird,
zone.
Yeah.
So wow. Members, we have a policy of if you've been to somebody else's water, you wash your gear down before you come back to members. We do it with the dragon boats. If you've borrowed a life jacket, wash it down at home before you bring it back to members. Same with the boats and the gear, it all gets washed down before it comes back. And we've also got a washing facility so you can clean stuff here as well.
Interesting. So,
because there's other things like parasites, and there's also weeds, blanket weed. We've had a touch of blanket weed on the lake as well this year, I've noticed, but it's been in little kind of specific areas, not like all over. I've had blanket weed in my pond and it absolutely chokes it to death, but when you're talking a bigger body of water, it's probably not as
yeah, but it's interesting though what the impact of climate changes, yeah. Isn't it? It's lack of rain and it's heat, and look what that's just what's doing to manvers. What about everywhere else?
Yes, it's a big knock on effect, and it's low to nature. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Oh dear. But anyway, you are a member of course, Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society.
Thank you for the plug.
Not at all. Doing very well. We're all waiting for the Sky at Night. It's going to be imminent soon, hasn't it? The episode.
So Sky at Night's on the 14th of September. Which will be a Monday night at 10 o'clock on BBC4.
Excellent.
So we've had a visit by Sky at Night to our observatory last week, and they came and filmed the night sky.
So did they film you, though?
They wanted our observatory to film in.
Oh, so you're not going to get name checked and everything?
Well, I've no idea. We wasn't allowed to watch the film crew, so we had a really good chat, Pete Lawrence and the film crew that came from all over the country, from Kent, Essex, and Glasgow, I think director.
Wow.
They came from all over, and they did about 3 hours at our observatory. Had a really good chat to them, lovely team of people at the BBC, and when we were doing the filming, we had to go out of the way while the film's cost the don't want people to know what's happened before it's televised.
Yeah, but that's going to be a brilliant thing to share on social media, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, when it's been on TV, we'll put something on Facebook.
Wow. Exciting stuff. So
it's been good, yeah. So we came specially to film in our observatory.
Before we talk about Eye on the Sky and stuff like that, tell us, last week you were hoping you would dodge the raid and sort of complete your home observatory.
Yes, so I've got a bit more to do. I've got some more work to do on my shutters, and I also need to fiberglass it. I've got paint on it, and I've sealed any cracks. And so the paint will kind of seal it, but I want to like proper weatherproof it, because domes get a huge amount of hammer, especially with the sun as well. So I noticed I've got some like grey paint on the dome. And it's kind of, when the sun's out, it does get warm inside. So this is one of the reasons why domes are white, so they can reflect a lot of the heat, but they still do get warm as well.
Wow, so you know, your observatory at Hoover, that attracts flies as well, doesn't it?
It does. It's like, hibernate. Yeah. If we once didn't use it for a month, and we went and opened the shutters, and there were like millions of flies.
So how are you going to stop that in your home-built one then?
Well, mine's more airtight. So where you can get the fingers round the joint of the observatory where it swivels together, I can't get my fingernails in between the side of the bit that spins and the skirts and the trims I've got inside. So it's like to a millimetre. So if any flies get in, I'll be surprised.
Yeah, well, we'll see, Phil. You know, nature's very good at...
The thing is, we have a fly swatter So in the observatory at Uber, we've got like a big zapping machine. So when they're flying, you can hear them crack. So the other thing is, there's other remedies like, is it the citronella tablets?
Oh, yeah.
Like the mosquitoes. So I'm having power into my building, my personal one. So I think I might get a mozzie or a fly repellent plug where I can have it on so it's giving off fumes so that it'll disturb the insects from coming in. I've had all kinds. I've been building it. I had a robin moving that was feeding every day. I've had damselflies, I've had earwigs, or ants, flipping calling ant, ants came through one day. Where's all these ants come from? So I've got the observatory. It's only 6 foot by 4 foot. I've got it on 4 timber posts, so it's off the floor, but ants get everywhere. So there's also, I might put some ant powder down.
But you're coming to the end of summer anyway, so
yes, it's the insects have subsided, but the insects love an observatory. I haven't had any spiders in yet. I've had some spiders on the outside, but not on the inside. Like the woodwork and the old hangers.
Brilliant.
So there must be some kind of trade-off between insects being in an observatory, but I prefer them on the outside.
Yeah. Brilliant. So what's worth looking at then in the sky coming up?
Well, we get into that time of year where it's becoming more socially acceptable doing astronomy. You can get out at 9 o'clock now. So as the nights are drawing in, you can probably go out about 9 o'clock, set your gear up, and then like probably just do an hour's observing session. So normally, other years, I'll probably just do an hour, because if you're taking photographs or looking for things, you do an hour, you're starting to get cold, and then you can start kind of come back in the house.
Yeah, but Phil, you're talking about this is before you built your observatory. All your equipment will be set up. It'll be toasty warm.
It will be. So I'll be able to go out, uncover everything, and just turn everything on, and then do a photographic session. So I've been photographing some galaxies and nebula. We've posted some on our web page for the club, and I've also put some on my own Facebook page as well. So I've also got, while I've been setting gear up and moving it up, building an observatory, the club's got what we call a Sea Star. It's a small Altair Merthyr robotic telescope. It's the same company that builds the Azier and ZWO cameras. They build the Sea Star. So basically, pair it to your phone, stick it in your garden in a dark spot, turn it on, pair it to your phone, and you've basically got a 2-inch diameter telescope that's robotic from your phone, and you can just drive it. And believe me, they are absolutely cracking.
Ooh.
You're talking £500 to buy one, but it is a take anywhere telescope when you can go on holiday. You can even go, with people even go abroad with them now, because they only weigh probably about 4 kilograms, I think, 3 or 4 kilograms. And the mini telescopes, and you completely control them from your phone. Absolutely magic. They're set up for doing deep space imaging. They're not very good on the planets. They're not really designed for the planets because the resolution isn't good enough, because it's only a 2-inch lens. If you're doing planetary stuff, you want a long focal, large aperture telescope. So it's really designed for catching things like nebulae and stars and clouds of gas. It's absolutely brilliant. So, yeah, it's a good thing to buy for Christmas.
Have you borrowed it?
I borrowed the clubs.
Before you even said that, I thought, I know where this is going. Oh, it's really good, and it's only £500, and you can take it anywhere. I thought, oh, and it's September, isn't it, Phil? Yeah, and I bet you want it, don't you? You need it. No, you don't want it. You need it.
It's a loan item from the club.
Yeah, but you need one now, don't you?
Yeah. Well, I've got a big aperture reflector, and I've got a smaller refractor. So it's kind of, I've got a big and small telescope. So now I've got the observatory. I can do it remotely just the same. So yeah.
Yeah, but you still want it, don't you?
I don't know. No, I'm okay.
It's not cheap, this astronomy business.
To be honest, what I need to do is spend £500 on a cooled digital astro camera. That's what I need to do.
Is it?
It is. That's the next step. So during the summer, I've had problems in July. It was that hot.
Oh, yeah.
The camera wouldn't take... The camera was... it had hot pixels. So when you're trying to photograph faint nebula, the pixels are too hot. In fact, if it gets over 20 degrees centigrade in the camera, it struggles to recognise and place off stars because of too many hot pixels. So what people do is they've invented a camera with a fan and a cooling system inside it. So you can chill your camera. I think you can get them down to something like minus 20 degrees. So the cooler the chips are in the CCDs, the better, the more receptive they are to light. So you want really your camera down 0 degrees or 0 degrees for better, how can I put it, for fainter objects. So if you're doing the moon, it's not a problem, but if you're doing things like faint hydrogen clouds in Cygnus, you want a cool camera. So at the moment, the camera's about 16, 14 degrees at night time. So as it gets colder, the picture should get better.
You're under the stairs, aren't you, Phil? Are you in your office?
I'm in my office.
You see, your signal, when we spoke to you last week, you were in your summer house, and it was brilliant. I've only got you in one ear at the minute, Phil.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear.
That's all you need.
That's all we need. So your priority isn't it's a cool digital camera you want, isn't it?
It is, yes. And the other thing is, when you've got a telescope, you can do other things to it. You can use different, you can put Barlow lenses on so you can double your magnification. You can put solar, you can put filters in the system so you can identify specifically wavelengths like hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen and sulfur. So you can do more things with a traditional telescope. The C star is like a package. You can have a solar filter on the front, but it's like a pack. It's an easy use package to be able to do astrophotography and basically learn the sky. It's also got a star atlas inside it. So if you want to learn where things are and what's up in the sky, you can use the atlas in the telescope that's on your camera as well.
Wow.
So yeah, it's they've changed the how can I put it, the accessibility to astronomy, made it easier. Yeah, I'm going to it's got its own little tripod, and it all comes inside a small box. So yeah, it's really good.
It's easier to do. So basically, once it's got you've got you hooked straight away. Basically, once you get, if you're just starting out and you've got something that makes it easier, you're just going to be off and running, aren't you? Not like, oh, what am I looking at? And
the other thing is, it's a phone format, so it's designed to be used from your phone. So traditionally, we use laptops, wires everywhere, and you know, you're out there in the cold with your laptop. Now you can set your gear up in the garden, Wi-Fi it back to your phone, and I'm using a laptop less and less and less. Plus the fact, this morning I turned my laptop on, Windows 11, an upgrade, and I've not got enough memory in my laptop to do my upgrade, so it's got to 25%, and it says I can't go any further.
We've had that one.
Yeah. So, yeah.
That's just a night. It's a con, isn't it? And it's a nightmare as well. It means you have to get another laptop.
Well, this is it. I've gradually been moving away from computers, and I've been doing more and more stuff on my phone. So a lot of the guys use things like Cyril to develop the photographs when they download them onto the laptop, so they can like pull more information out and bring out different colours and tones. I've got programs on my phone. I can do the same stuff now. So I can download a photo, 2 minutes on time, pull something out, and then I can put it on a post. And I can do that without using a laptop at all.
Amazing, isn't it? So, out of interest, what phone have you got, and does that make
a
difference?
Got an Apple phone. Well, the later versions are better, but if you've got any Apple phone and you the downloads apps on you know, on your Safari or whatever, it works. So, C-Star, I've got their own app, and it'll download on. They do Android and all the other stuff as well. We just use Apple.
Well, interestingly, after all this time, I've always wanted to know the order of the planets, and I could never get my head around learning them, and I've done it. Okay. I've used that mnemonic.
Go on, then.
My very educated mother just served up 9 pizzas. But obviously Pluto's the pizza, and that's not technically a planet anymore, is it?
No, it's a minor planet.
But it makes you remember it. So it's Mercury,
I'm
Venus.
Okay.
Mercury.
Lots of people are happy.
Yeah.
But go on then, Mercury,
Mercury Venus.
Venus,
Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. Correct?
So, absolutely correct.
Yes! Easy. Not only that, Phil, Holt's planet suite. What do those planets bring, each of them?
Oh, I don't know.
Ooh! Well, Mercury is it the winged messenger?
All right, yes. Yeah.
Venus is the bringer of peace. Mars is the bringer of war. Jupiter is the bringer of jollity.
Is it? Right.
Is it Saturn is... Oh, the bringer of old age. So we don't like Saturn.
Time is the god of time.
Uranus, I think, is it the magician or the mystic? The mystic.
Okay.
And Neptune, I think, is the magician, or it might be the other way around. But yeah, look what we've done.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an improvement.
It is. And I thought it comes to a quiz question or anything like that. Yeah. Whoa.
Oh, where's the asteroid belt coming?
Oh, is it beyond Pluto?
No. That's the Kuiper belt.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, similar thing, but further away. It's in between Mars and Jupiter.
Is it?
Yeah, that's where the that's where the main asteroid belt is. There's asteroids all over the solar system, but that's where the main congregation is, in between the two. It's because Jupiter won't let a planet form. Asteroids get to about 1,000 kilometres in diameter, and then they kind of get either thrown out or pulled to pieces by Jupiter's gravity.
Oh, that's a bit mean, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
It's supposed to bring jollity. And why didn't Hulse do a track about planet Earth?
I don't know.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Duran Duran did.
Yeah, they did. Do you know, that's a lower tone now. But anyway, moving on. Anything else you want to tell us about your club or what events coming up, talks?
There's the RSPB on the 18th.
Oh, there is? That's coming up very quickly, isn't it?
5 o'clock onwards.
Yes, that's the Friday the 18th of September.
So you can have a walk around the RSPB reserve. I think there's also a back walk, and then we'll be doing a presentation and having a look through the telescopes, because it should be dark enough shortly after. So the nights are joining, will come in really quick. So you'll still be able to see things like Sagittarius, Capricorn, Aquarius, Pegasus is coming up. Cygnus is still hanging about overhead, and Cygnus is really, really good for the clouds, hydrogen clouds. And also you've also got Cassiopeia and Cepheus, which are all overhead, really nice objects, stars and clusters to look at.
That's if you've got a clear sky, as always.
Yes.
You need to have that.
Yeah, there was a break in the clouds last night. I got the sea star out, turned it on, and the clouds came back in.
But having borrowed the sea star, obviously that's a beauty of being in a club, isn't it? You can borrow something.
Yeah.
Would you really want one then? Yes. Now you've used it.
Definitely. Ideal for, I don't know, you go to the Lake District for a week. I wouldn't take my gear because it is too big. So it's absolutely ideal for plonking on a table or on the grass in a camping field, and just like have a look around the sky at what you can't see.
Yeah, amazing.
It's really good, really, really good.
So as you said...
That's where I'd use it if I had one.
So if you had one... On the Christmas list. So what else is coming up? Because it's this time of year, isn't it, where you're saying it's getting great for viewing, because you can go, you don't have to stay up till God knows what time.
Yeah, so 9 o'clock's a nice time to go out. 9, probably 11. Saturn's coming up in the east, and it's going to be moving across the sky. And then we've also got Neptune in Pisces, along with near Saturn. And then we've also got Uranus coming up about midnight. And then there'll be Mars coming up in Gemini. And then there's also Pluto, Jupiter's coming up late in the evening, early in the morning. So the planets are starting to come round. So it'll be nice on the run up to Christmas as the these constellations are moving around the sky.
And if you can just use an app, you always say you can just use an app and it'll show you, tell you where to look.
Stellariums are really good at looking at the sky. And if you point it up the sky and press your phone a couple of times, you can actually get the picture of the sky, and it'll also look through your camera so you can compare the stars on your app with the stars in the sky.
Oh, do you know what? How did we manage before all this, Phil?
Yeah, we had to learn.
We had to, but it's true, isn't it? Yeah.
It's like with navigation. It's like before we had maps, sat-nav, it's like I used to enjoy learning about navigation and where things are. It's same for a flight. If you go on holiday on a plane, I have to sit in the window so I know where I am. So I can pick places out.
But navigation is a fascinating thing, because obviously we were sailors, so we had to learn with charts and a handheld compass. We weren't.
It's a bit like the analogy is a bit like having a calculator. Having a calculator, it kind of makes you lazy with maths.
Yes.
You need to learn the maths first, because if you punch, like, what are fours? If you don't know, if the 16 or thereabouts, if the number comes out vastly different from what you're kind of expecting, you know you've typed the wrong number. And it's a bit the same with navigation. It's okay having a sat nav, but when that road's blocked, you need to know a diversion round it.
Or when your sat nav fails, we've still got a paper map book for driving.
Yeah.
And I still love it. Might be out of date sometimes, but it's easier.
I've got an A5.
Oh, good old fashioned. There'll be kids out there going, what?
A5 map. Map in the van. So if we go away, I've got a basic road map.
Yeah.
A roads and motorways, essential. If you're travelling across country, you need to you need a map so you can work out where you're going.
Amazing. And on that note,
my kids don't know if they're going north or south. If we're going the A1, they don't know if we're going north or south.
Hey, a good tip for that is look at where the trees are growing. They grow towards the sun, so you know that's south, and stuff like that, yeah. So, do you know we learn such a lot on this show, Phil? But I'm going to have to let you go now.
Yes, thank you, Phil.
Thanks for joining us yet again.
Have a nice month.
Yes, you too. We'll speak to you soon. Bye-bye, Phil.
Bye-bye.
Bye.